Yeah, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Government State Government Finance Committee to order. We are meeting today under the remote conditions. It's a remote hearing authorized under Rule 10.01 of the Minnesota House of Representatives. And with that, we'll get started here. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 108. I'm the author of that.
Sure.
Yes.
Could you note that we do have a quorum?
And thank you. We do have a quorum. And with that, the first bit on the agenda is House File 108, special session House file. And members, if you remember, this is a bill we had during regular session. We passed out of our committee. It got passed on the floor. The Senate didn't just get to this at the last day of session. And what this is the authorizing MMB to be able to extend grants on a case-by-case basis. There's only one minor tweak on the bill. There was some concern with the LCCMR, whether they had the ability to do that, extend their grants. And so we just tweaked the language so that they definitely know they can do that. And with that, members, if there are no questions, I'll take the roll on the bill. Are there any questions? Representative Albright, I see you got your hand up. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the benefit of the GOP side of the committee, I would encourage a yes vote on this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Get a second here for any hands. I see no hands going up. So, Mr. Simon, can you please take the roll on House File? I renew my motion that House File 108 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cleborn.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Hertas. Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Keel. Representative Lippert.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Vogel. Great.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I know that technology being what it is, I'm wondering if your CA might call and remind the folks that did not answer either in the affirmative or the opposition to the bill one more time, please.
Yes, Simon, if you'll do that, call the people that didn't respond.
Yep, I can do that. Representative Hertas and Representative Keel. I know she just joined us.
And so, Mr. Simon or Mr. Brown, what is the tally then?
Yeah, it is 16 ayes to 2 absent.
Thank you. Of that, the House File 108 is referred to Ways and Means. The next bill on our agenda is House File 111, and I'll move that House File 111 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And there's a blank in there that we have to fill in having to do with the amount, and there's also an amendment, but let's first get the dollar amount filled in. And Mr. Johnson, are you on the call here?
Yes, I am.
What is that number that we need to put in that amount? Have we finally come to a final decision on that?
$9.7 million.
$9.7 million. So I'll move that. And Mr. Gehring, where exactly does that need to go in?
So, Mr. Chair, this would be an oral amendment on page 1, line 6. You delete the dollar sign in the blank and insert 1,600,000.
9 million what?
Sorry, I missed the 9,600,000. Is that the right number?
700,000.
700, okay. Sorry about
9,700,000. Thank you.
Yeah. So line 1. Yep, line 1.6, delete the blank line and insert 9,700,000.
So everybody, are we aware, are we understand what the amendment is? All in favor of the amending House File 111 on line 1 point, or page 1, line 6, to read $9.7 million, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
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 The ayes have it. The other amendment we have is Representative Hewitt. You have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I do. Would you like me to explain the amendment in details right now?
Yes. Well, why don't you move the amendment and then...
Mr. Chair, I'd ask that we move the A1 amendment as follows.
Representative, you moved the A1 amendment. You want to describe the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is a very straightforward amendment. Due to the COVID crisis, many of our state agencies have been affected by this amendment here. Basically, it covers some losses that the zoo experienced, the Minnesota Zoo and Apple Valley experienced during the COVID crisis. The zoo depends on 2/3 of its total budget for gate fees and donations. They totally lost that as they had to close one of the first weeks in the COVID crisis to protect their staff and their in the state's asset out there, the animals. So what I'm asking for is a $6 million loss cap.
Members, any questions on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, are you the author of the House File 111? Or just the amendment?
Just the amendment, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright.
Representative Cagle is the author of the amendment of the bill. I mean House File 111.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, could you explain to the committee what $6 million pays for?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I do have with me today John Frawley, our Minnesota Zoo Director, and I would call on him to get into more of the details of what he needs the $6 million to cover.
Is it Frawley?
Yes.
Mr. Frawley.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members.
You heard the question. Can you answer that? What the $6 million covers?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you, Ms. Rep. Hewitt. As Rep. Hewitt pointed out, like a lot of state agencies, the Minnesota Zoo receives only 1/3 of our operating budget. From the state, 2/3 of our budget is earned revenue and through our foundation. So that model completely flipped upside down on us on March 14th when, on almost a $29 million budget, 2/3 of it stopped coming in. The timing was also hard on the zoo as that's our peak season going into the spring and into the summer. Our anticipated modeling, we modeled this out and our anticipated losses are gonna be about $6.3 million. In losses, plus we've used all of our reserves and any dollars we had on our books. So as of the end of June, we'll have depleted all of the resources at the zoo. So this $6 million brings us back to the point where we would be able to open the zoo with a socially distanced zoo and hopefully in the near future, like other organizations around the state. But even with this $6 million, I'm sure you might have seen in the media, Zoo had to go through a layoff situation and laid off over 50 staff, and it also affected over 125 employees. This money would allow us to have the basic needs to be able to reopen the zoo, including this also included us. We had to do the layoff, so it was we're in a very critical position. This is critical support for us to keep this world class zoo in a position to reopen.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Frawley, I certainly sympathize with your plight with regard to the zoo. Could you let the members of the committee know on a bare bones perspective, notwithstanding the $6 million appropriated or requested as an appropriation, what it would take to make sure that the animals contained at the zoo are maintained in good order?
Mr. Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, also with us today is our CFO, who has put all the modeling together for this request. So if I could call on Abigail Mosier, our CFO for the Minnesota Zoo, who's on this call as well.
Ms. Mosier.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Abigail Mosier. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. And I may need a little bit more information on the representative's question to make sure I answer it correctly.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mosier, if you needed to maintain the health of the animals in good order, notwithstanding an unknown startup date for the zoo itself to visitors.
Were you looking for me?
Oh, not yet. What would the
so I can't talk, but
what would your baseline burden cost be to maintain the exhibits and the animals therein in good order?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's a good question. I'm not sure I'm prepared today to give that exact number, and that's something we could work on with the committee. What I will say at this point, though, is the modeling that we've done so far, and the decision making that went into the layoffs we've done so far, was to look at what would it take to maintain the zoo in good working order in terms of caring for the animals and caring for the campus and the asset that the state has invested in over time, as well as maintaining the skill sets and the staffing needed to be able to reopen to the public. And so what we'd be talking about in a scenario where we reduce further is really impairing our ability to reopen to the public and have those guest-facing and serving capabilities in addition to caring for the animals and the assets. So if folks are interested in us modeling out the scenario you talk about, that's something we could work on and get back to the committee on.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mosier, I think that is exactly what I'm asking for, given the fact that the uncertainty that there is speculation whether or not even schools will be opened up on a full force basis come the fall. I think you can certainly appreciate the fact that you may not have visitors if that were to occur, given the fact that a large majority of your attendees come from school districts in the fall to attend visits as part of their curriculum. With that in mind, I would like this committee to review your pro forma without opening up based upon a baseline burden to make sure that the exhibits and the animals therein are maintained in good order. I'd also like to know what your run would be in terms of length of a time before the next legislature convenes in January. Is that what you're looking for in any regard, or is it just what is the finite timeline for the $6 million that you requested so far?
Ms. Mosier or Mr. Frawley?
Mr. Chair, I can add that the $6 million would be necessary to balance the budget for fiscal 21. So we would not, under this scenario, without the $6 million, be able to balance our budget for the year. We would, as the director said, we're already going to be running low on cash before we reach July 1. And then we would not, after we receive our appropriation, we would not have sufficient revenue under our current projections in a socially distanced environment to maintain cash flow for the entire year.
Mr. Chair, no more questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No more questions, but I do believe that this bill would be going to Ways and Means on its next stop. I would expect that Ms. Mosier and Mr. Frawley would have that prepared for us by the time it receives its hearing in Ways and Means.
That's okay, members. Members, before we vote on this, Representative Cagle, are you okay with this amendment? It's seeing as how it's your bill.
Yes, Mr. Representative Chairman. Cagle. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with this amendment.
Okay, Representative. I got two more questions. People with their hands up, Representative Green. You had a question. Trying to unmute you.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah, I would speak against this amendment. Although I'm sensitive to the zoo's problems, I'm also sensitive to the fact that businesses across Minnesota are feeling the exact same pinch. And with the governor's shutdown and his refusal to even release the CARE funds, I don't think it's a good idea, and it sends a poor message that we're bailing out state agencies while we're keeping the private industries shut down. And so I would encourage a no vote on this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Green. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And Mr. Frawley, Ms. Mosher, could you tell me what was the amount of money in budget reserves before we had the lockdown from COVID-19 and the declaration which shut down the zoo? How much money did you have on hand?
Mr. Frawley or Ms. Mosher?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll chime in, and the director may chime in as well. So how the cash flow works at the zoo is we do receive a appropriation from the state, which contributes to our cash on hand, as well as we have the earned income that was discussed earlier. And so what we try to do on an annual basis is to maintain a budget reserve of at least $1.5 million. So that we are able to withstand the usual variations in weather and attendance and other things. We did have that budget reserve fully funded before COVID hit, as well as some additional cash on hand that was ready for investment in projects around the campus to maintain the zoo and grow the zoo. So it serves well the folks in Minnesota. And so we had, we were on track to end the year with probably around $4 to $4.5 million on hand, which is pretty typical to manage our cash flow and be prepped for the upcoming fiscal year, considering that we begin the fiscal year in the middle of our high season. So that is, as the director said, the cash that we have depleted. We've worked to cut expenses as much as possible during this time frame, but the reality is, and you've probably seen some of the national reporting on this as well, zoos are unlike some other types of entities where our costs to maintain closed are almost as high as our costs to stay open because of the high cost of animal care for our animals, our collection of nearly 5,000 animals. Unlike a number of other entities, we are not eligible under the federal law for federal stimulus, including the federal paycheck protection program and some of the other tools that other organizations are using right now. We also do not have access to lines of credit and some of the other tools that other zoos and seasonal attractions use to manage through this crisis as well. So as a state agency, we are limited in the tools that we have, and that's a big reason for the $6 million request in this case.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hertaus, and remember, before you go on, I'm going to remind people that we have three other bills up here that we need to get done today, and otherwise we're going to be back here at 8 o'clock tonight to finish up. So, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, and I'll be brief. So my question is, once you had noticed that public places like the zoo were going to be closed, did you lay off unnecessary, unessential staff, or were the budget reserves exhausted in maintaining staff in anticipation of reopening shortly?
Mr. Frawley or Ms. Mosier?
Mr. Chair and members, as the director talked about, we did very quickly, as we realized we would be closing, work closely with leaders in the executive branch, as well as members of the legislature, to make our financial situation known. We did immediately reduce hours for all staff who are not guaranteed hours. As a state agency, our workforce is unionized, so we work through those union requirements in consultation with Minnesota Management and Budget and other officials. And so we did reduce hours staffing as much as possible, short of layoffs. We also immediately moved to cut our non-salary expenses as much as possible, especially while closed, while still, of course, maintaining the asset. We operate like a small city, and so we run our own heat plant, we maintain our own roads. There's a lot of ongoing wear and tear and maintenance that can't be completely ignored, but we have deferred as much as possible. Then we worked closely with officials at the state to work through a layoff process and scenario in consultation with the unions, and move through that as quickly as reasonable, especially given we had to figure out what the future of the zoo would look like in terms of physically distanced service to the public, and try to, as best possible, make reductions in ways that would allow us to still successfully reopen in this environment and serve the public in accordance with our mission. And so we did move through all of those steps up until now, and we've been working very hard to preserve our cash flow as long as possible, given, you know, the environment that we're all working with here with the COVID.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Quam, if you could make it quick, I want to get a vote on this quickly.
Thank you, here. Mr. Chair. And frankly, I wanted to note that over the years, I've been very pleased that the zoo has decreased the portion of funding, annual funding, that they've used. In other words, they started out with a great deal of state funding, and it's decreased over the years to a, I think, a surprisingly low level. And the fact that we have decades of background and stuff to help out to make things work, I think that investment would be put at risk if we didn't try and maintain it. So I'm just speaking in favor of the intent of this bill, while not saying that the amount is going to be adequate or is appropriate. Thank you.
With that, members,
Mr. Chair, one final comment, please.
Representative Hewitt.
I want to thank the members, and Representative Green, I understand, I empathize with you, but this is a promise legislators before us made to the state. This is an asset of ours. It's not just in my district, although my district does have an economic impact from this. And I really have to say that, like, I remember one of the things as a freshman, the great statement I heard was from Representative Hurtas, and his statement was, a promise made is a promise kept. And so I would like to leave you with that as you're thinking about your vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All members, with that, all in favor of the amendment, the Hewitt amendment, please say aye. The E1 amendment.
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
Nay.
With that, the amendment's been added. Representative Cagle, you want to explain the bill as the original bill for the National Sports Center?
Thank
Representative
you.
Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. House file, you can hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. House File 111 is a general fund appropriation to the National Sports Center in Blaine, and due to COVID-19, the National Sports Center has had to cancel all the events that would normally fund the organization. Before I turn it over to my testifiers, I'd just like to share a quick personal story. When I was about 11 years old, my cousin from Washington, D.C. came to Minnesota to play in the U.S. Cup. And my grandpa drove down from Silver Bay and brought me and my friend to every one of my cousin's games. And it seemed like all of his games were ending in shootouts. And one of those times we were waiting for kind of like the shootout cage, there was another team there from the UK that was in the shootout. And so I started talking with the player's family and asked them what they thought and if they planned to visit any other parts of the state. And then my cousin's team actually got second place in that tournament. For the 12 and under group. And instead of going back to DC with his team, he stayed in Minnesota to visit the family.
And so about a week after the tournament, my grandparents brought us and a bunch of the grandkids up to their home in Silver Bay for a week. And my cousin and I walked down to the Dairy Queen, because that's what you do in Silver Bay. And we ran into that British family that we had chatted with at the U.S. Cup, and they were vacationing on the North Shore after the tournament. And I just shared this story to kind of show how large the reach of the National Sports Center is, not only for Blaine, but for the North Metro and for the entire state. So it's a huge asset to our area. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to Todd Johnson from the National Sports Center.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. If you can please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the National Sports Center and the Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate I know we're under a time crunch here, so I'll abbreviate my comments, make them as quick as possible, but I really want people to understand that the National Sports Center, which is if you think about it as the management agency for the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, we are the custodians of $170 million replacement asset for the state of Minnesota. And in its 30-year existence, we have never received any money in operating subsidy for this facility. So it does me a little bit of a painful ask to ask, but we're really in a situation where we don't have much of a choice, since we are totally dependent upon the events that we have. To date, we've had to cancel 57 events, including our flagship that Representative Cahill just mentioned, the USA Cup, which is nearly 20% of our revenues. And I know there's many of you members who have either participated in it yourselves as players, or if you had grandchildren. Representative Nash, I know you've been involved. You understand the scope of that tournament and the breadth. We were on pace to have 1,200 teams from 20 countries and from 20 states descending on us right about this time. Right now, we'd be getting all those preparations ready. Right now, because of the virus, we are operating at about 20% of what we normally would. The reason there was a little bit of discrepancy, Mr. Chairman, about the dollar amount that we were looking for was literally in March, we were asked for an estimate on what it would cost when we were completely shut down. That's all 8 of our ice rinks were down. We're up to 4 now. That number was $13.9 million. As we've been able to gradually get some things up and running in a very, very safe fashion, that's how the number got reduced down to $9.7 million to get us through the rest of the fiscal year.
Thank you. Representative Albright, I see you have your hand up.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Johnson, unlike the zoo, can you help me understand what you need to keep alive?
Absolutely.
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We believe that number right now is 9.7 if we want to continue to maintain the level that we are right now, which is 4 of our 8 sheets of ice are operating. And we've drastically changed, Representative, how we are operating this summer. We did not bring back any part-time labor. We don't have the staff that we normally do whatsoever. We actually decided we would stop running events. And what we really are now is a facility to keep other private businesses open. If you think about all the private either ice skating instructors or the hockey programs or the soccer programs that are on our campus, we are supporting and ensuring that these private businesses can continue to thrive. And we are not running our events, which is normally a number next is about 72 events that we run at the facility. And we're not running any of those events. We're really becoming a facility for other private businesses to run their businesses. So 9.7, our utility bill alone at the ice rink is nearly $1 million a month. A million a year. That's one huge piece of it, just keeping 700 acres mowed, those sorts of things. So we are at a skeleton staff. That's really the number we're looking at is the 9.7. That answers your question.
And members, again, I'd encourage brevity and when you're with your answers and your questions. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, how many sheets of ice do you have open and what is their utilization?
We have
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have four of our eight sheets of ice open, and I believe our utilization is at about 75%, 75% right now. Going from 8 in the morning until 10 at night.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of the soccer fields that you have, how often do you need to mow them, and what is your utilization there?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those numbers are much. We have to mow them twice a week, at least right now, given the growing conditions that are going on, just to keep up with the acreage. We are probably at 25% utilization on our soccer fields right now.
Representative Albright.
That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel, I see you have your hand up.
I have to unmute.
Yep,
there we go. Thank you. I just had a quick question about the private businesses that the arena or at the National Sports Center avails themselves to. How many, Mr. Johnson, do you know how many actual businesses you support so that they can provide their services?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I could give you the exact number, but off the top of my head, there's probably at least upwards of 25 when you talk about individual private, if you include private ice skating instructors for our ice skating folks. There's the Blaine Soccer Club with 4,000 participants. There's Fit Hockey that has people coming from all over the metro region. But I will give you that exact number if you'd like. I'd be happy to provide that to you.
So it'd be about 20, 25. But yeah, it would be nice to know how many you provide. Thank you.
I'll get that back to Representative Hill.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File, the number right, 111, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Simon, if you'll take, or Mr. Brown, if you'll take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Green. Representative Hertas.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Keel.
No.
Representative Lippert.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
And again, Representative Green.
I've been trying to unmute him.
No. I'm a no vote.
Got it. The vote then is 11 ayes and 7 nays.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that, the House File 111 is referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The next bill we have under amendment is House File 54, Representative Becker Finn. And I'll move House File 54. Have it before the committee and to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Becker Finn, if you want to describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the bill that's been discussed in the overall public safety accountability package related to the Attorney General's office. And specifically this bill, the Attorney General would have prosecution of peace officers alleged to have caused an officer-involved death. And the reason we're making a stop in your committee is that there is a fiscal note and a cost attached to that, as the Attorney General's office currently does not have the means to conduct that many criminal prosecutions. Obviously, these cases are very complicated for anyone who's attempted to follow along with any of the cases in recent years. They take expert witnesses. They require multiple attorneys, lots of staff, gathering a lot of evidence, going through body cam, video, really complicated cases. And so the idea here is that we would create uniformity and consistency in these officer-involved death cases by having the Attorney General's office handle those cases. And another piece to why that is so important is that currently the jurisdiction is with the county attorney because it's a felony level at where the event occurred. And I can tell you as a prosecutor myself, I've worked as an assistant head of the county attorney on domestic violence prosecution cases. And you work very closely with the law enforcement agencies that are located within your jurisdiction. And so there is significant concern from the public that by having the prosecutor's office that already works very closely with that law enforcement agency handling a case, that, you know, even if our prosecutors and everybody is trying to do their best, there's still that perception that there may be, it may be hard to remain neutral when it's a government entity, another law enforcement agency that you work with on a regular basis. I can tell you personally, was working with literally with Minneapolis cops across the hallway from me in Hennepin County in Minneapolis when the Jamar Clark case was going on. And, you know, it just creates this awkwardness. And I think, we want to make sure that we have that consistency, we have that uniformity, we have that transparency, that there isn't some kind of favoritism or something going on or any kind of complication by prosecuting essentially an entity that you also have to work with on sometimes, you know, hundreds to thousands of other cases. So that's the idea with this bill. It is supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I believe there was a letter that was sent out. And others have been supportive of this as well. And I'm happy to take questions. Thank you, Mr.
Before we get to questions, members, there's an amendment we have to do there on line 3.6. There's a blank that we need to fill in. And I believe the amount for that we need to put in there, and I'll make that oral amendment to put in $1,636,000 into that, into line 3.6. And Mr. Gehring, am I correct with that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The way I understand it, line three, or page three, line six of the bill, delete the blank line, insert $1,636,000.
Thank you. That's my amendment. That's my motion. Members, any questions on the motion, on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment to put the dollar amount in there, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's passed. Members, I've got, I think, two people who want to speak on this, one being Ms. Moline from the Attorney General's office, and I know the other one here, too, my brain just, and then Jim Baxter, excuse me, from the county, Minnesota County Attorneys Association. So, Ms. Moline, if you want to state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Carly Moline, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. In the summer of 2019, Attorney General Ellison, along with DPS Commissioner John Harrington, announced a working group to identify ways to reduce deadly force encounters. The group included geographic and racial diversity, as well as representation from disability and autism advocates, mental health experts, law enforcement, and criminal justice stakeholders. After four all-day public hearings and three evening listening sessions, the working group completed its work earlier this year with a recommendation of 38 action steps. One of those recommendations was that the Attorney General and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association should continue working together to discuss and develop ideas for how the Attorney General's office can be supportive and engaged around deadly force encounters in terms of expertise, resources, conflicts, jurisdiction, and other issues. We have taken that recommendation to heart, as has the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And since the conclusion of the working group, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has expressed their support of the Minnesota Attorney General's office having original jurisdiction to prosecute deadly force encounters in Minnesota. House File 54 amends Minnesota Statute 8.01, adding 8.37 to provide that the Attorney General has charge of the prosecution of peace officers alleged to have caused an officer-involved death in the course of their duties. Currently, our authority to prosecute criminal cases is upon request of the county attorney of jurisdiction or appointment of the governor. The prosecutors in our office handle homicide cases, typically in greater Minnesota, where smaller offices lack the resources and manpower to handle complex homicides. We also prosecute other cases in which a conflict may exist. For example, we're prosecuting a sexual assault case in northwestern Minnesota where the defendant is a sheriff's deputy. Our office is prosecuting the officers responsible for George Floyd's death upon request and in conjunction with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. We are all committed to obtaining justice for George Floyd and his survivors. Without additional resources, House File 54 significantly impacts the ability of the Attorney General's office to provide current legal services to individual counties in the prosecution of other cases that county attorneys request that we handle. It's also important to us and within the spirit of the work group recommendation that we partner with county attorneys so that we can share the expertise and experience they have in their offices. House File 54 does not require county attorney assistance, although a county attorney may assist if requested by the Attorney General. There is no provision that requires the county attorney to share in the fiscal responsibility of the prosecution, including the sharing of any expert witness fees or travel-related costs. While there is no way to know the number of cases that will be referred to the Attorney General under this legislation, these prosecutions have increased in recent years. In the last 4 years, there have been 3 officers prosecuted in the state of Minnesota for causing a death in the line of duty. There have been documented 117 cases of an officer-involved death since 2010, averaging about 11 to 12 per year. In review of the last several cases handled by the Criminal Trial Division at the Attorney General's office, which are typically homicides, attorneys averaged 557 hours per case, and legal assistants in our office averaged 759 hours per case. Should House File 54 become law and assuming 10 equivalent reviews of officer-related deaths per year, the Attorney General's office would require an additional 4 FTE attorneys and 5 FTE legal assistants. Transparency to the public demands a meticulous review of all the relevant evidence, including body cam, squad, and surveillance video, witness statements, and witness cell phones, including social media evidence, as well as disciplinary records. Attorneys will spend time reviewing and coordinating the investigations and make charging decisions. For cases in which charges are filed, attorneys will spend time prosecuting the charges and handle any appeal where a conviction resulted. For cases in which charges are not filed, attorneys may spend time advising the post board and the law enforcement agency in possible disciplinary action if necessary. Because of the technical nature of the cases to be reviewed, consultation with medical experts and use of force experts will also likely be required in both the review and prosecution if charges are filed. Costs associated with expert witnesses are also reflected in the fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Becker-Finn, as well as Representative Long, for the work that's been done on this proposal. And I'm available for any questions, as is Deputy Attorney General David Voigt, who oversees our criminal division. I know that County Attorney Backstrom is weighing in as well, but we will be on the line for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moline. Mr. Backstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I have been privileged to serve in that capacity for over 32 and a half years in my community. I am a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and a past president of that organization. I appear today to speak to this important bill on behalf of the County Attorneys Association. We held a special meeting on June 4th to address this issue and to recognize that in the time we find ourselves in our state and in our nation, we believe It's important that we stand and rise at this important moment and stand for some criminal justice reform that improves transparency, accountability, and community trust. We believe that that's what this legislation will do. While we don't believe that, you know, we have an inherent conflict of interest in these cases because we've handled them fairly and impartially for many, many years, we do recognize that there is a growing number of persons in our society that believe that there is a conflict of interest when a county attorney reviews the alleged criminal conduct of a member of a law enforcement agency that we work with in our communities on a daily basis. So it's in recognition of the importance of ensuring that everyone has faith in the process of these extremely important investigations that the County Attorneys Association voted to support the transfer of prosecutorial jurisdiction in these important matters to the Minnesota Attorney General's office. We pledged our assistance to Attorney General Ellison to assist him in these cases whenever that's necessary. I will add that one of the important things that we also included in our motion in connection with this matter is the importance of funding, adequate funding to the Attorney General to handle these cases. As Ms. Moline just indicated, there's a significant amount of work involved. These are complex cases. They're important cases. They require expertise to handle. They require training of the attorneys that are hired by the Attorney General to address these matters. And we really strongly encourage you to support this in a financial manner that's a part of this proposal with the amendment that was added today. I will add that one of the concerns raised by county attorneys in our state, especially the outstate county attorneys, the smaller offices that rely heavily on our Attorney General's office to assist them in the prosecution of major crimes, murder cases, that they simply don't have the resources to handle. And the Attorney General has stepped up in a very meaningful way, particularly in the last year and a half, and we're grateful for that, to assist county attorneys throughout our state in handling these cases. And one of the concerns was that if we transfer jurisdiction in these cases, we don't want that to adversely impact the Attorney General's ability to continue to assist county attorneys in the process of major and significant cases in smaller jurisdictions across our state. And that's why it's very important that adequate funding be made available to the Attorney General to handle these cases. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions, but thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
And again, I want to remind people, brevity is our friend. Representative Albright, you have your hand up.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a question for you or for counsel to the committee, but I note that this is an appropriation that would be anticipated to be expended, but I'm just wondering if for some reason, we certainly wish goodwill to the Attorney General, but in the event that the $1.6 million is not needed, would that appropriation revert back to the general fund?
Mr. Chair, this is Helen Roberts.
Ms. Roberts.
Yes, you're correct. Because it's a general fund appropriation, it would cancel at the end of the biennium back to the general fund.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple questions for Mr. Backstrom, if he's willing.
Go ahead.
Mr. Backstrom, I note in what is already in statute at the beginning of this bill that when the governor requests, the Attorney General shall prosecute any person charged with an indictable offense. I'm just curious then why we need to make special provision under subdivision 2 of the bill, where the Attorney General has charge of the prosecution of peace officers, if we already have in statute the nature of that authorization given to the Attorney General by the governor, if he so requests it in writing.
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do recognize that language exists in current law. However, we do believe it's important to be very clear for purposes of maintaining confidence in the impartiality of these decisions, that there be a very clear language to indicate that all officer-involved death cases would be handled by the Attorney General without the need for having the governor to intervene in those matters. So that's what this legislation will do. We do think it's important to have that in place across the state. So thank you.
Representative Albright.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, under jurisdictional authority, wouldn't it be the county prosecuting attorney's discretion to call any attorney general in light of a sophisticated case anyway?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the county attorneys do on a frequent basis, especially in the smaller jurisdictions. This doesn't happen in the larger counties in our state, but in the smaller jurisdictions, the attorney general is requested to assist county attorneys on serious cases such as murders and others, and including cases of this nature. It's been done before. Oftentimes, smaller jurisdictions have asked larger county attorneys to handle these types of cases as well. But again, to ensure consistency and transparency and uniformity across our state, the purpose of this legislation is to ensure that one office has jurisdiction over these important matters.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, is this considered a co-equal counsel, or is the county prosecuting attorney subordinating his authority to the Attorney General?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would be the county attorneys giving up their jurisdiction if this law passes, or would take the jurisdiction away, I should say, from county attorneys and give this jurisdiction to the Attorney General. There should not be two offices that have a joint jurisdiction in any case. There needs to be one office. We do believe it should be an elected official, and the Attorney General as a constitutional officer and an elected official in this great state of ours is, we believe, the right office to handle these matters.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. To that end then, Mr. Backstrom, could the Attorney General on his discretion determine to supersede the authority of the county prosecuting attorney based upon whatever distinctiveness or the highlighting of a specific case and supersede the authority of the county prosecuting attorney, notwithstanding the request by the county attorney?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, under current law, absent the intervention of the governor of the state of Minnesota, the attorney general cannot assume jurisdiction over any criminal matter from the county attorney other than those that are, there's a few crimes that are specifically specified in law. Financial-related crimes where the Attorney General has original jurisdiction. But in all other cases, it's the county attorney that has jurisdiction over criminal matters in our state. And absent a request from a county attorney or the intervention of the governor, that jurisdiction cannot be taken away.
Mr. Chair, I just have one final question. And it would go to, actually, Ms. Moline.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. Ms. Moline, in light of the appropriation that's been requested, is any portion of that determined to be necessary for the case currently before the Attorney General?
Ms. Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, no, the enactment date of HF 54 is August 1st, and so we haven't contemplated costs associated with the prosecution of the officers involved in George Floyd's death in this request. We are prosecuting that case upon request in conjunction with Hennepin County and have an arrangement with them on this particular case.
Ms. Moline, then, in light of your designation of four new JDs as well as four paralegals, would you contemplate hiring those before you have a case or after you have a case brought to you?
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. We would start bringing on people as soon as the law became enacted so that we would be prepared when a case would be referred to us.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Moline, what happens if a, And what happens to those people if a case, God willing, does not bring itself before the Attorney General's office?
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. That would be a good problem for the state of Minnesota to have. As mentioned, on average, there's 11 to 12 deadly force encounters each year in Minnesota, actually a slight uptick over the past 2 years. I believe there was 14 in 2019. So if we had original jurisdiction to prosecute those cases, it would be highly unlikely that we wouldn't have any referred to our office. If that were to happen, then the legislature would, I guess, have to revisit it. But, you know, looking at the last 20 years and the last couple of years specifically, it would be highly unlikely that we wouldn't have cases referred to us for review. Whether or not those go to charging and prosecuting, you know, those decisions wouldn't be made until after a full investigation and review takes place, which the attorneys would also do.
Ms. Moline, thank you, Ms. Moline. Last year you mentioned there were three cases where an officer involved shooting. You say over the course of the last several years, there's been 11 to 12. You're anticipating 10, but that's with existing staff. Why is it necessary to bring on additional staff if you've been able to handle 10 officer-involved cases without additional FTEs?
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. We don't currently handle those 10 cases per year. The county attorneys of jurisdiction handle those. We use the number of deadly force encounters to calculate how many cases we would be reviewing if HF 54 becomes law.
One final question, Mr. Chair. Is there a difference between review of a case and prosecution?
Ms. Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yes. I mean, you know, the way that the law and the proposals are set up is that the BCA and local law enforcement initiate an investigation and refer it to our case with to our office with a recommendation on charging. The county attorneys or would-be assistant attorney generals under the proposal would then review the case, oversee the investigation, and do a very thoughtful review of all evidence before a charging decision is made. As was mentioned, there's 11 to 12 deadly force encounters in Minnesota each year, and only three of those have gone to prosecution, and that's been in the last 4 years.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'll hold a final comment before we take the vote. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Quam, quickly.
Here, and I am curious. I thought I saw language in which they could utilize the county attorney for some of the staffing and assistance on a case, but I didn't think I noticed anywhere that the counties would be reimbursed since we're specifically funding for the attorney generals. So what is the mechanisms that the counties would be reimbursed since we're funding the AG for this?
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. There's no provision that allows us to have reimbursement from the county under both current law and the proposal.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if we're basically saying we're not going to have any improvement from statutes that we're passing now. In fact, I think a large portion of the activity in the special session is to try and decrease the possibility of these events. So the assumption is we're not going to see any decrease. We're funding it and we're hiring the people, but we're also looking at, gee, we might end up having the county attorneys do this. I just think if we did require, the county attorneys to take care of some of this load, then some of that funding should be directed back to the counties, because that's the intent of this bill, is to actually pay for it through the AG. So apparently maybe we can look at having that corrected as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that question, Representative Quam, if this bill were to go forward, the counties would actually save money because they wouldn't be reviewing and prosecuting these cases. So as things currently stand, the counties are doing this work already. And so there wouldn't be any need to give them additional funds when this is actually taking something off of their current caseload and in theory would then save them money. So I don't think there's any need to divert any of these funds to the counties because, again, they currently have the jurisdiction, you know, and any additional assistance that's requested, it's not required, you know, they're requesting and they have to cooperate with the Attorney General, but that's not going to be any additional work than what they're doing currently.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Why have it in there that you're maybe handing off part of the activity? If we're funding for the AG, then the AG should just do the job. But if the AG says, well, we're having authority or we're overseeing, but we're going to have the county attorneys do the job, then the county attorney would not be saving money because they would still be putting effort forward. I just think you're projecting that it's going to basically stay the same, even though we've got many bills out there to decrease the possibility of this coming forward. So hopefully we would see fewer cases after all this effort that's being put into it. So we'd be overfunding and they'd be overstaffed. And I just want to make sure that if we give you the money, you're going to do the job. And I was just surprised by the language that was in there. Thank you.
Representative Hertaus, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Backstrom, you mentioned the need to maintain impartiality with regard to these use of force prosecutions with police officers. And it's my understanding that all of the 87 county prosecutors' offices are nonpartisan offices. Isn't that going to be difficult to maintain impartiality when you have a partisan office in the state attorney general's office?
What was that question, Mr. Backstrom?
Yes.
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we recognize that county attorneys are nonpartisan elected officials and the attorney general is a partisan elected official. But that office is a constitutional office in our state. It is elected to the state of by the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and it's directly accountable to those citizens for the work that's done. And I will say that every prosecutor, regardless of whether it's the attorney general or a county attorney, has ethical obligations as a prosecutor to do what's right, to do it in a fair and just and impartial manner. And I have confidence that our attorney general will do just that in connection with these important cases.
Representative Hertaus, follow-up?
No, we'll save time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Long, the last questioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I know we're short on time. I just wanted to acknowledge what a significant decision it was on the part of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association to give up their responsibility in this area. And as County Attorney Backstrom mentioned, it wasn't because they don't believe they're capable of doing this or because even they believe that they have a conflict, but it's because of the appearance of conflict and the trust issues that that creates with the community. And Ms. Moline mentioned that there have been three prosecutions in recent years. The most recent of those occurred in my district. And the level of trust with the prosecution there was very low because of the perceived conflicts of the county attorney's interactions on a day-to-day basis with the police. And that created even significant press coverage about those conflicts and whether that case could be done impartially. So this is, I think, a very important step to make sure that we are having an impartial system that has the public trust. And I think that making sure that the Attorney General's office has the resources to do these appropriately is important to make sure that these cases are investigated and prosecuted appropriately. So I want to thank Representative Becker-Finn for bringing this forward.
And with that, Representative Becker-Finn, if you can give a short wrap-up, and I mean short wrap-up, and then we can get to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this bill is about consistency and uniformity to make sure that all Minnesotans, regardless of which county they live in, have that consistency and uniformity in the prosecution of these complicated cases. And I appreciate your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 54, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Brown, if you'll take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Akam?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No. No.
Representative Hertaus?
No.
Representative Hewitt?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Keel? Representative Lippert?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
And Representative Vogel?
No.
I'm just checking again. I wasn't sure if I heard Representative Keel. Okay.
No. You can't seem to unmute.
I'm sorry. No. Got it.
Again, the tally is 11 to 7.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. With that, this bill will be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The next bill on our agenda, the final bill on our agenda, is House File 89. And I'll move that House File 89 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Noor, if you want to describe your bill. And I believe we have an amendment. Do we want to do the amendment before you describe it or after?
Representative Noor. Thank you, Mr. Chen. I think we need to do the amendment first.
Okay, I'll move. And Mr. Gelvin, what's the number on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, the amendment is A1.
Okay, the A1 amendment. Thank you. I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 89. Just kind of quickly describe the amendment, what that does, how it changes the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment puts the amount, the $125 million for the Promise Act, and also it provides the $5 million administrative expenses. It also gives the determination for the amount of aid or award to be given to the commissioner to determine.
Thank you. With that, members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is on. Representative Noor, you want to describe your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is part of the Promise Act package. This is a comprehensive economic package in response to the incident that took place in Minneapolis, the civil unrest after the death of George Floyd. We have listened to many of the business owners. We've listened to many of the community members who have seen the destruction and the damage that was done to the neighborhood. So we have come up with a package whereby we create a special master panel to address the need so that we can provide immediate assistance to distribute the fund, one-time disaster assistance to eligible individuals. This sets a process whereby the governor will appoint 3 to 9 panel members. The panel members will be listening to the community and hear their issues and make a determination of how much they should be awarded. The commissioner will create a process whereby a consultant or an employee will provide help to the panel so that they can make a decision based on the need that exists.
So simply put, this is a process we want to make sure that we rebuild our city. This is our commitment. This is our obligation to the communities that have been impacted. And quite frankly, most of the business owners along the corridors in St. Paul and Minneapolis are people of color, indigenous, who have spent their wealth to build their businesses. So we want to make sure that we provide the help they're asking for at this time. So the individuals who are going to be considered as a nonprofit or a business owners for the application process for this. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Moore, Representative Noor. And who are we, our testifiers first?
What do we? Mr. Chair, I have Davis to testify, the first person who will testify today.
Fine, Mr. Davis, you want to proceed, state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Davis Sensman, S-E-N-S-E-M-A-N, and I'm a small business attorney and a member of the Main Street Alliance Advisory Board. So I work quite a bit with small businesses, and I just wanted to urge the committee to pass this bill because there's specifics in this bill that speak to the issues that small businesses have faced with previous federal and state kind of packages that aim to help after COVID. The use of a panel to award, to triage and prioritize these awards and then to make them will help the state avoid a lottery system where it's just randomized and you're unable to kind of prioritize those who need the most help. And I would also like to just remind the committee that there were small other pockets, particularly on the north side in the Victory neighborhood, that saw damage. And so I would hope that the legislature would urge the governor to kind of name those particular businesses that saw fires as an additional, as is allowed by Section 2, Subdivision 4-3. But all in all, this bill is kind of exactly what these small businesses need. They're exactly what's needed to avoid complete gentrification and displacement of these small business owners. And the use of a panel is really kind of an innovative and a I think, satisfactory way to kind of review these claims, triage them, and prioritize awards. I would just urge the legislature to, I see that the last deadline for providing, there's a March 2021 deadline because there's a September, that gives about 6 months after the last applications have to be made. And I would just urge folks to kind of do everything they can to make sure that this panel kind of gets these done more quickly. I would imagine that there will be sorting out of insurance claims and what should be the responsibility of a landlord and what should be the responsibility of the business owner. And the panel will need to look at that, but I would just urge the legislature to kind of get this money out quickly to these businesses and the citizens that have been affected, because otherwise we're just gonna lose these businesses. I'm happy to answer any questions too.
Thank you. I also have a Johi Pomplum. You wanna please identify yourself for the record and give your testimony.
Hi, yes, thank you. My name is Juhi Pomplin. I reside in Representative Jordan's District of 60A. Thank you, Chair Nelson and committee members and Representative Noor for this bill. I'm the executive director of the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. The Alliance is an alliance of 33 organizations with a mission to advance racial, economic, environmental justice and health equity in the way growth and development occurs in the Twin Cities. And I'm additionally in relationship with over 20 grassroots community development organizations supporting our small businesses and micro enterprises in our Black, Brown, Indigenous, and immigrant communities to survive the COVID and now the civil uprising. As I read the House File 6, House File 3989, I was seeing intention to set a culture for award compensation for the damages to those that were affected by the civil unrest. And in that culture setting, I ask that you leverage this panel to support our uprising by transforming how government executes its role at this time. And you can do this by ensuring that the panel is led by values of equity and undoing the 400 plus years of harm that has led to the uprising. And so let this panel have a mission and not just a function. So centering the decision-making of the panel in our Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities by having us at the table and lead the panel, keeping the lawyers for the technical assistance that supports the community panel and awarding the compensation equitably, but often lawyers act as wet blankets to innovation, and we ask that the lawyers play a critical role in supporting the creation of pathways for innovation. That you make the nonprofit organizations defined in the bill that the panel must engage with within each zone be the same consultants the bill allows the panel to hire for assistance and pay them for doing the work of the state. Provide additional attention to ensuring not only a geographic relationship to the impacted zones, but also the cultural relationships between organizations and the communities, thus strengthening community institutions on whom our communities already naturally rely. And to make sure that when those checks go out to
Ms. Pomplin, can you wrap up here so we can get to questions?
Yes. Please, making sure that those checks go to repair the damages that are going to repair damages are going to our communities as well. The repairing is a very concrete and visible step towards healing, and that should be done by our communities in the work and materials that are provided. And lastly, that the property owners who receive the checks, they don't sell the property out from under us or try to up the rents to push us out of our spaces. That provisions in the awards are there to protect our most vulnerable and protect our communities and allow the award process and not allow the award process to displace our communities. So I appreciate this bill. I believe that it can do more and support the uprising and adding an equity and anti-displacement lens to its procedures. And I hope you consider my statements upon implementation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Noor, I don't see on the call the other person I had on my list, the Miss Elison Ness from the city of Minneapolis. I don't see her on the call. So I'll go to questions. Representative Noor.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I don't see the city of Minneapolis member, but we're ready to answer any questions that the members may have.
Thank you. Representative Albright, you had a question. Representative Albright, you're still muted.
My apologies, Mr. Okay. Chair. I guess first off, Mr. Chair and Representative Noor, as I look at the body of the bill itself, I am a bit at a loss for understanding why lines 1.16 through 2.7 are even necessary. I understand that bills from time to time, with the author's discretion, certainly afford some preamble to the context of the bill itself, but when you place such a distinctiveness on the preamble in this context and then assert that it is of a legislative finding, we've had no agreement, not that we don't disagree with the tragedy that befell South Minneapolis as an outcome, but to put that into code, into statute, Representative Noor, I'm just wondering what your intention is by that.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this sets us to look deeper into what really happened. There is no way of you know, circumnavigating the whole process. We need to identify when injustice happens in our cities. We need to identify why we're coming up with these resources. Quite frankly, many people feel that they've been abandoned by their own government for the incidents to happen. So we have to understand there's a historical background to this package. There's a reason why we're bringing this bill forward, and to also address the harm that was done to many of the communities who have been impacted. So it justifies for us to say the purpose, why are we bringing this bill forward, and to be able to provide the financial assistance to many people who have built their wealth through, you know, their own savings. They've built and revitalized many of the community corridors that we're talking about on Lake Street, Midway to Broadway. Those are places that play a vital role in the economic engine for the state of Minnesota. So this is a recognition for the harm that was done.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I can certainly appreciate what the communities that you serve have and are going to go through in this environment. But what you've just described is a subjective opinion that is yours. It may not be shared by everyone holds an election certificate or otherwise. And the means and the matter of law is to instruct rather than to give opinion. And so I would just caution you that language itself may, and certainly in my opinion, is not needful to enact legislation that would be helpful to the people that suffered damages. Mr. Chair, before I ask a couple of follow-on questions, can you elaborate for me two points? Is the path of this bill, and also is there a companion in the Senate?
Representative Albright, I'm not sure whether there's a companion in the Senate. It's my understanding this bill is a piece of a larger bill that's going to be assembled in Ways and Means Committee that we are hearing this. This is a clone of that larger bill. We're hearing this too, because this is the part that parts of this that affect our committee. And so that's why we're hearing it. And it's going to get sent to Ways and Means, and it's going to be part of the larger bill. It probably won't go forward as House File 89, but it'll be part of a larger bill. And to the about the intent, yes, we try not to put intent and findings into statute, but it's not unheard of. It's been done in the past. We don't normally do that, but it has been done in the past. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, you are asking for a substantial appropriation from the state of Minnesota. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate for the members of the committee what coordination and or initiatives have been brought forward by either Hennepin County or the city of Minneapolis directed towards this same circumstance.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair and members, there is a commitment from the Hennepin County, also from the city of Minneapolis, to really address the need that exists. This is going to cost billions of dollars. It's not going to be the amount that we're giving right now, but we want to make sure that we rebuild and not leave behind the businesses that have been impacted. So there's a commitment from the county, there's a commitment from the city, there's a commitment from the philanthropic community who have stood up in a quick way to rebuild so that not only it comes to the way that it was, it comes to a better shape and increase the economic engine, economic opportunity for so many individuals in that corridor.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Albright, just to remind people, we have to be done at 2:15, and we're going to be taking a vote on this bill before the end of that, before 2:15. So please keep your questions concise and your answers also concise. Representative Albright.
Certainly recognize that. Representative Knorr, on page 6, you talk about payments from other sources, subordinate. We're subordinating to those. I'm also wondering then if the state appropriation, if there ever becomes one, would that be subordinate to both the Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis in terms of the appropriations that they would put forward?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I would like to defer that section to Matt explain in details.
Mr. Gehring.
Matt Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, so that language is intended to primarily ensure that insurance companies still pay out amounts that recipients are owed under their insurance plan. It's not specific about what would happen if there were further county or city appropriations made available for the same purpose.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, on page 3, you talk about the makeup of this special master panel. And I do note that there is a determination of between 3 and 9 attorneys. As you crafted this language, I'm curious why you did not include anyone from the business community or the insurance community that would have specific and expertise in the property casualty as well as appraisal and or the rehabilitation functions of what your community is going to be looking for. Why was it only delegated to attorneys?
Representative Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I think if you read down the line, it says individuals who have good legal and business knowledge expertise. This is to help, shape from what we've had when the 35W collapsed. But this is more intent to allow individuals who can consider claim process and provide guidance. So there is an inclusion for legal expertise and also business expertise in the bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, on line 3.24 of the bill, you identify a fee or budget for this panel. Do you have an idea in terms of what that would be filled in by? Do you have an amendment to fix that? Or what is the plan for that missing component?
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think we just approved that. There's a $5 million administrative cost and up to $25,000 per panel member for compensation.
Representative Albright, one more question, then we have to get to a vote. Representative Albright.
Yes, thank you. And I'm just wondering, Representative Knorr, if you have anything or anyone that would be able to talk about the calculation of the amount on line 4.14 through, again, line 4.20, and maybe your amendment satisfied my question in terms of the maximum amount of the award. But if you could unpack and explain a little more in detail how those awards are provided.
And Representative Albright, that was part of the amendment that we put on at the beginning.
Mr. Chair, could you tell me what the maximum then is?
Representative Knorr, if you want to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, we are going to take all the applications and provide based on the need that exists. So we cannot come up with just an open-ended amount. So we will make sure that every claim that is put forward, that we have some resources to provide to those who put forward the claim. So the commissioner will determine how much that amount will be.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Albright.
Thank you. On line 4.19, it says the total amount of an award to any single eligible person must not exceed. Are we not in the process of determining what that maximum is? But what Representative Knorr just described is you're going to hop everything
Representative Albright, I'm going to call on Mr. Gehring. That was part of the amendment. I believe it's $25,000. But Mr. Gehring, on that amount that we filled in line 4.20.
Mr. Chair, so on that line, the A1 amendment that was adopted does remove that line and instead directs the panel to determine what the maximum amount should be per award once it's received all the applications.
And I misspoke, but yes, that's Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and Ms. Sensman and others, no one can certainly appreciate more than you the loss of what your business and you personally have suffered. But Mr. Chair, we're asking the legislature to deficit spend. This bill, along with the other three that we've talked about in this committee, we don't have money for. We're looking at a $2.4 billion deficit. And I'm wondering where this committee or any other committee that would entertain any one of these bills in this collection that's been brought forward in this special session, where the cuts are coming from to balance with the expenditures that certainly are have merit, but we have no money to appropriate them if we don't consider commensurate cuts.
Representative Albright, I understand that, but right now we have to take a vote on this bill. I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. And I'm sorry, Representative Vogel, you had your hand up. I have to cut you off. We need to take a vote on this bill. So, Mr. Brown, can you please call the roll? First, I renew my motion that House File 89, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Committee on Ways and Means. Mr. Brown.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Claiborne.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Elkins. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hertas.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Jordan.
Yes.
Representative Keel.
No.
Representative Lippert.
Yes.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mason. Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Kwan.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
And again, Representative Elkins. And Representative Mason.
Aye.
The vote is 10 ayes to 7 nays.
With that, members, this bill is on its way to Ways and Means. And with that, members, we have no further business before us. The meeting's adjourned.